One of the sophists, who was an actual contemporary of Socrates, younger than Socrates, Antiphon. This is a very nice passage because it encapsulates the attitude of the sophists and tries to show how they really were related to the Greek natural philosophers. And the interconnection between sophistry and natural philosophy is one of the topics that is brought up with and dealt with in a very comical way in the Clouds. So let's just look at this passage from Antiphon. Justice is a matter of not transgressing what the laws prescribe in whatever city you are a citizen of. So justice is simply a matter of legal convention. Okay? There's no such thing as justice by nature. But the Greek word there for justice is dike, and you could also translate that as right. All right is conventional, not natural. Now that's a teaching of the natural philosophers too. When they looked at nature, they didn't see any right and wrong. They just saw natural processes borne along by forces of necessity. They didn't see any good or evil. And so they regarded concepts like good and evil as human conventions or human creations. And Antiphon begins with this as the first principle here. A person would make most advantage of justice for himself if he treated the laws as important in the presence of witnesses, and treated the decrees of nature as important when alone and with no witnesses present. So here is the distinction between what exists by nature and what exists by convention. Right or law exists by convention, whereas the decrees of nature are natural. And what are the decrees of nature? They're our desires. And he's saying that the person who lives best gives due regard to the conventional laws when there are witnesses around, and follows nature whenever they can get away with it. For the decrees of laws are extra additions, those of nature are necessary. Again, there's this notion of necessity here. Not will, not choice, not intelligence, but necessity is the underlying principle of nature. Those of the laws are products of agreement. In other words, law is conventional. Not of natural growth, whereas those of nature are the products of natural growth, not agreement. The decrees of laws are created by human beings. The decrees of nature just happen by nature. If those who made the agreement do not notice a person transgressing the prescriptions of laws, he is free from both disgrace and penalty, but not so if they do notice him. But if, contrary to possibility, anyone violates any of the things which are innate by nature, the evil is no less if one notices him, and no greater if all observe. For he does not suffer harm as the result of opinion, but as a result of truth. If we transgress the laws of nature, it doesn't matter if there's a witness there, we're still going to suffer the consequences, is his basic point. This is the entire purpose of considering these matters. That most of the things that are just according to law are established in a way which is hostile to nature. So this is the next teaching. Not only is there a distinction between what's by nature and by convention, but conventions are hostile to nature. And that's really true. Just think about all of our natural impulses and how conventional notions of right and wrong are an impediment to satisfying them. For instance, frat boys are constantly being brought up on the awareness of the fact that conventions about consent and so forth get in the way of their satisfying their sexual desires. Conventions about appropriate behavior in certain circumstances interferes with satisfying your desire to eliminate bodily wastes. So if you gotta go, you gotta go, but you can't just go anywhere, right? I mean, conventions get in the way of the satisfaction of natural needs. If I'm hungry and I don't have any money, I'm screwed by these conventions, right? you have to steal. You know, transgress conventions, the police get after you, and so forth. So by its very nature, conventional laws serve to limit the satisfaction of natural desires. And the sophists thought that that's bad. It's bad because nature is the only thing with any real dignity or worth. And convention doesn't have that kind of dignity or worth. We shouldn't give it that much concern. We have to respect it only insofar as those conventional-minded people who might see us violating conventions might get after us, right? Throw us in jail. But if they're not around, then we should follow the decrees of nature. For laws have been established for the eyes as to what they must see and what they must not, and for the ears as to what they must hear and what they must not, and for the tongue as to what it must say and what it must not, and for the hands as to what they must do and what they must not, and for the feet as to where they must go and where they must not. You know, I mean, you can't look at pornography, you can't listen in on other people's phone conversations, even if you'd really like to. You can't say anything you really want to say or do anything with your tongue that you really want to do. You can't put your hands just anywhere you might want to put them. And you can't go by foot or plane or automobile anywhere you want to go. Right? He's enumerating it in rather nauseating detail, I suppose. And for the mind, as to what it must desire and what it must not. Okay? Convention gets inside our minds and limits the kinds of things you're willing to consider. There are conventional-minded people who would never consider doing anything even slightly naughty or untoward because they have the whole of society sort of embedded in their heads, monitoring them and making them feel guilty for even thinking about things that are unconventional. And this is a frustration of the liberty of nature. Follow our desires wherever they lead us. Now, the things from which the laws deter humans are no more in accord with or suited to nature than the things which they promote. Living and dying are matters of nature, and living results for them from what is advantageous, dying from what is not advantageous. But the advantages which are established by the laws are bonds on nature, and those established by nature are free. So if we live by the bonds of nature, we're free. Right? If we live under the bonds of convention, we're not free. So what freedom is just living in accordance with our natural desires. And so what we've lost through conventional laws is our natural liberty. And so, things that cause distress, at least when thought of correctly, do not help nature more than things that give joy. Therefore, it will not be painful things, but rather than pleasant things which are advantageous. And this is another element of the Sophist teaching. They define what's advantageous and what's disadvantageous, and let's just put it more finally, what's good or evil in terms of pain and pleasure. They're hedonists. And you're going to find this in the clouds very clearly when you hear the unjust speech. Right and wrong is just equivalent to good or to pleasure and pain. For things that are truly advantageous must not cause harm but benefit, but the things that are advantageous by nature are among these. And then there's a lacuna here, unfortunately. The papyrus wasn't complete, so we're left to wonder. But according to the law, those are correct who defend themselves. Oh, and here's what the law tells us to do, and this is interesting. The law tells us to defend themselves after suffering and are not first to do wrong. We have to wait until we've been aggressed against before we can defend ourselves for the law. You know, we hear this all the time. But the stalker hasn't done anything yet. You can't send the police. Wait until the person actually attacks you, and then we can send the police. You know, that's what the law-abiding citizen has to put up with, right? Well, that's just not good according to nature. And those who do good to parents who are bad to them, those are people who are good by law, right? You honor your father and mother even if they're monsters. That's what the law prescribes. But nature doesn't. And you also follow the law, he who permits others to accuse them on oath, but do not themselves accuse on oath. You know, meaning those who go around and tattle on others. A law-abiding citizen doesn't go around tattling on his neighbors, but he sits around and waits till his neighbors tattle on him before he can defend himself. And of course, some of these things are slanders, right? But you can't aggress against another person. You just have to wait until they aggress against you. That's what the law-abiding do. We'll find most of these cases hostile to nature. They permit people to suffer more pain when less is possible and to have less pleasure when more is possible and to receive injury when it is not necessary. Now, if some assistance came from the laws for those who submitted to these conditions and some damage to those who do not submit but resist, obedience to the laws would not be unhelpful. Unfortunately, that's not the case. The laws often don't benefit those who submit to the laws and punish those who don't. But as things are, it is obvious that the justice that stems from law is insufficient to rescue those who submit. In the first place, it permits the one who suffers to suffer and the wrongdoer to do wrong, and it was not at the time of the wrongdoing able to prevent either the sufferer from suffering or the wrongdoer from doing wrong. And when the case is brought to trial, there is no special advantage for the one who has suffered over the wrongdoer, for he must persuade the jury that he suffered and that he is able to exact the penalty, and it is open to the wrongdoer to deny it. However convincing the accusation is on behalf of the accuser, the defense can be just as convincing, for victory comes through speech. So this is a pretty bleak view of human society. It's bleak, but it's actually terribly accurate. And so what's the solution? Well, the solution is to not be so damned law-abiding, but instead to pursue your advantages by all the tools you have available, and one of the most important tools is the art of speaking. But also, necessary, if somebody's going to do you harm, you have to be willing to do harm to them before they do harm to you. Otherwise, you're going to be a victim. It's a very tough-minded philosophy that the sophists preach. People of Kennesaw with their well-armed houses, or the Swiss with their militias, or the kinds of people that are not messed around with as much as the ordinary citizen. This is a good background, though, this little passage from Antiphon to the Clouds. So let's look at the Clouds now. This is such a rich and wonderful text. The Clouds was premiered in 423 BC, when Socrates was about 46 or 47 years old. And it was premiered in the spring, in March or April of that year, at the great festival known as the Pan Athenaea. And every year at this festival, the city of Athens, through donations of various wealthy citizens, put on a number of plays. They put on 9 tragedies, and that consisted of 3 trilogies, each trilogy written by the same tragedian. So the Oedipus trilogy was one of the things premiered. The Oresteia was another one of these trilogies that was premiered at the Pan Athenaea. They also put on 3 satyr plays, which were lighthearted treatments of mythical topics, and they put on 3 comedies. And there was a contest for the best tragedy trilogy, the best comedy, and the best satyr play. And the Clouds came in dead last in the competition. Interestingly enough, though, there was another play premiered that very year that also was a parody of Socrates. It was by a comic playwright named Anthesius. Nothing has survived of this play, but we know that it was voted either first or second place over the Clouds. But Aristophanes, of course, has gotten the last laugh because the others have perished. 2 years later, in 421 BC, another comedy by Eupolis on Socrates was premiered. So 423 was the year of the 2 Socratic parodies, the first 2 Socratic parodies. The Clouds is the one that has survived, and it was probably the best of them. Now, the plot of the Clouds is very simple. Strepsiades, who's a country gentleman who has a certain amount of land outside the city of Athens and a certain income and is basically makes his money by working his land, has married the niece of Megacles, and Megacles is the name of, you could translate it almost as Big Shot. The niece of Big Shot, from a wealthy urban family, and his wife has all kinds of expensive tastes, and their son is sort of a cross between 2 different groups, the country gentry and the citified aristocracy. And he's sort of a man between, and his name itself reflects that. Pheidippides is a compromise between an upper class aristocratic name, has the word, the root for horse in it. And fathers desire to name the child something equivalent of an old-fashioned virtue. So Pheidippides was the compromise, and it basically means thrifty horseman, which is a very strange concept then as today, because you don't find the poor keeping horses, right? And Pheidippides' desire to have horses and chariots and other expensive accoutrements has put his father in great debt. father is forced to mortgage his land and things like that to spoil his son. And he's very much an indulgent father, that's quite clear. But the time is coming to pay off his debts, and he's trying to figure a way out. And so the old man decides to try something newfangled. He wants to send his son to the Thinkery, which is a school that's run by Socrates. And it's reputed that in the Thinkery, Socrates teaches how to make the weaker speech the stronger. And what does that mean? Well, the weaker speech is the morally weaker speech. And to make the weaker speech the stronger means to make the morally weaker speech more effective in persuading people. So it's morally weak, but persuasively strong. And he wants to send Pheidippides over there to the Thinkery to learn how to make the weaker speech the stronger. And Pheidippides, after swearing an oath to his father that he will do this, when he finds out what his father wants to do, breaks the oath immediately, and he doesn't want to go there at all. And it's interesting that Strepsiades only knows a little bit about the Thinkery by reputation, even though it's right next door. But his son actually knows the names of Socrates and Chaerephon. And again, the son is a sort of person who is between the traditional classes in the society. And the fact that he knows Socrates and Chaerephon's name indicates that they are themselves, too, are sort of on the margins of the society, or between, they don't quite fit into any normal part of the society either. The Thinkery is a little run-down building off to the side. Now, Socrates was supposed to have inherited a small house from his parents. Socrates says in Xenophon's Memorabilia the following: "Just as another is pleased by a good horse or a dog or a bird, so I myself am even more pleased by good friends, and if I possess something good, I teach it, and I introduce them to others from whom I believe they will receive some benefit with a view to virtue. And reading together with my friends, I go through the treasures of the wise men of old, which they wrote and left behind in their books. And if we see something good, we pick it out, and we hold that it is a great gain if we," and I think he means we and the wise men of old, "become friends with one another," because the other people are already as well. And this really does refer to what might be considered a kind of thinkery, where Socrates and his friends get together and study philosophy. So there's some reason to think, on the basis of Xenophon's testimony, that that might exactly be what Socrates did, that in his little house he gathered together friends and they studied philosophy. So there's some reason to think that the Thinkery is not just made up, that there really was something like this in Socrates' life. It was probably his little run-down house. Since Pheidippides refuses to go to the Thinkery, Strepsiades goes in his stead. And Strepsiades is initiated into the Thinkery and educated there, but he's just too stupid. He's just too slow to get all this stuff. And so he's flunked out. And he's finally forced to send his son, and this time he's successful in persuading Pheidippides to go to the Thinkery. Pheidippides goes to the Thinkery and turns out to be a better pupil than his father, and he learns how to make the weaker speech the stronger, and he becomes a rather shameless little SOB in the process, and his father fets him with the graduation dinner, and in the midst of the dinner they quarrel about poetry, and the son beats up his father. And the father rushes into the street and calls for his neighbors, whom he has wronged himself, and asks for them to be witnesses to his plight. And then the son proceeds, by means of arguments, to persuade his father that it's just to beat him. But when Pheidippides tries to persuade his father that it's just to beat his mother as well, the old man snaps, and he won't hear another word of it. And instead, he goes and he calls his slaves, and they take a hoe and they climb onto the roof of the Thinkery and they break the roof tiles, and then they set the whole building ablaze, and Socrates and his students are forced to flee. And that's the end of the comedy. Now, there's a lot of dirty language and funny jokes and sort of slapstick in here, but I think that it would be a mistake to think that this is just sort of goofiness, because this is really a philosophical work. And I would argue even more strongly that it's the first fully extant philosophical work that we have in the Western tradition. Now, many people who comment on the clouds simply treat Aristophanes as a poet, and Aristophanes is treated, is widely regarded as a terribly reactionary poet. And there's no question about that. He was an old-fashioned reactionary. He hated all the newfangled things that were going on in Athens at the time, and fought against them and mercilessly parodied them in his 13 surviving comedies, which are magnificent. In fact, they're the only complete comedies that have come down to us from ancient Greece. There's some almost complete comedies by Menander of the next century, but only 13 complete comedies exist, and they're all by Aristophanes, and they're all fabulous. And it's very clear that he is a conservative or a reactionary sort. Yet at the same time, he's not what you could call a mindless conservative or a reactionary in the sense that he simply defends the old ways because they're old. He's a new kind of defender of tradition. If he were just a mindless reactionary, he'd be like most all the other Greeks, or most, you know, or like virtually every other member of a traditional society, which regards things that are ancient to be good simply because they're older. This is the traditional pre-philosophical worldview. What's old is good just because it's old. Aristophanes seems to regard the ancient ways as good, but not just because they're ancient, but because he has another kind of appeal, another kind of principle that he appeals to in order to argue that the ancient ways are good, and that's an appeal to nature. Now, this is very strange, because up to this time, you find that those thinkers who appeal to nature are precisely the ones who are most contemptuous of human conventions, especially long-standing, refined human conventions like traditions and old-fashioned customs and so forth. These are the things that they think are the older, the worse for the natural philosophers and for the sophists. If Aristophanes is appealing to nature to validate tradition, he has to have a very different conception of nature than the natural philosophers and the sophists who appeal to nature to invalidate tradition and convention. And I want to argue that that's true, and that his conception of nature is radically different in two ways. First of all, Aristophanes is interested in human things, in human nature, whereas the pre-Socratic natural philosophers began with a conscious attempt to turn away from human things, merely human things, because they didn't see anything in the human realm besides conventions. And it's very easy to believe that man has no nature when you see how plastic human beings are, how amazingly adaptive they are to all kinds of different situations, how amazingly corruptible they are, how amazingly perverse they are. There doesn't seem to be any limits to human behavior, any intrinsic limits to human behavior. It's very, very easy to think that man is just conventions all the way down, or historically evolved traditions and practices all the way down, that there's nothing natural about us. But Aristophanes does see that there's a human nature. And the second thing that's most extraordinary about his appeal to nature is that he has a notion of what's right or just by nature, whereas the pre-Socratic natural philosophers and the sophists had no conception of what's right or just by nature. Their only conception of right was purely conventional, and they didn't think that convention really mattered. So Aristophanes represents the first thinker who appeals to a notion of human nature and the first thinker to appeal to a notion of natural right in the philosophical tradition. And it's on the basis of his understanding of human nature and also this notion of what's right by nature that he comes to a defense of the traditions of Athens. Now, there are many reasons to think that he's not entirely a defender of Athenian tradition. In a number of his plays, it's very clear that he thinks that the gods have to be overthrown in some ways. That's very clear even in this play. What we're going to find as we look at the contest between the just speech and the unjust speech is that the just speech loses Yet the just speech is supposedly the speech that Aristophanes is most in sync with. It represents the conservative party, in a sense, in Athens at the time. Yet Aristophanes, who is the playwright and has some control over what happens in his plays, contrives to let the just speech, his own side, lose. And you have to ask why he wants the just speech to lose. Well, if you look at why the just speech loses, you realize the points on which Aristophanes thinks that the traditions of Athens are weak and the things that need to be transformed in order to preserve them. And again, every classical conservative thinker, Edmund Burke is an excellent example, have always recognized that an institution or a practice that doesn't have the capacity to change does not have the capacity to conserve itself. And so to conserve old Athens, he regards it as necessary to change old Athens just up to the point where the weaknesses are eliminated. So we're going to see what he thinks the weaknesses of the traditional position are. But for the most part, you would have to call him a conservative thinker. Let's just start going through the play. There's some just wonderful passages here that are sort of rich with meaning, and we could spend 6 or 8 hours looking at this. So let me try and be brief. On page 119, the bottom of the actual Aristophanes text, Strepsiades first points towards the thinkery, and he says, "That is a thinkery of wise souls. In there dwell men who by speaking persuade one that the heaven is a stove and that it is around us and we are charcoals. If someone gives them money, they teach him how to win both just and unjust causes by speaking." Now, this claim that the heaven is a stove and that we're charcoals, you know, these are sort of typically goofy Strepsiadian misunderstandings of natural philosophy. And this is one of the first things you notice about Strepsiades. He just doesn't understand science or natural philosophy. And what he does, whenever he hears a proposition of natural science, he translates it into something that's familiar to him. And what's familiar to him are practical considerations and bodily functions. So we hear a great deal about farting. Okay, in this play, because apparently Strepsiades is quite familiar with that. We hear a great deal about food, because again, that's something that ranks high in his list of priorities, and ovens and charcoal and things like that, and kneading pans and measures for barley and so forth, are all things that he finds intelligible to him, and nature he finds entirely unintelligible. The idea of a non-human world, or a world, an objective world that you approach not through the categories of human concerns and practical interests is entirely foreign to him. So, again, the claim that heaven is a great, you know, dome overhead becomes, it's like an oven, which we're domed. And the idea that human beings contain this power of reason, which Heraclitus likened to fire, to him means that we're all like charcoal. We're all on fire in the stove. Strepsiades doesn't know their names precisely, it says at the top of 120. I don't know their names precisely. Pondering thinkers, noble and good man. And it's interesting, this phrase noble and good man, kalos ka agathos is the Greek, can be translated as gentleman if you don't want to do it literally like the person here is doing it. Strepsiades thinks the guys over in the thinkery are gentlemen. And this sort of is an indication of his social class. He's an uneducated man, a rustic, a country farmer. And intellectuals to country farmers are higher on the scale, the social scale. Whereas Pheidippides' reaction is entirely different, and this shows how he thinks of himself as in some sense on a higher social level than his father because of his inheritance from his mother. He goes, "Ugh, villains, I know. They're boasters, pale, shoeless men that you're speaking of, and among them that miserably unhappy Socrates and Chaerephon." Socrates indeed went around shoeless. This is one of his common features. And there are many, many features of Socrates that we know from the Platonic dialogues that appear in this play. So there's a great deal of historical accuracy. At the center of 120, Strepsiades says, "It's said that they have two speeches, the stronger, whatever it may be, and the weaker. Of these speeches, the weaker wins, they say, although it speaks the more unjust things. So if you learn this unjust speech from me, I wouldn't give anyone back even an obol of those debts that I owe because of you. So this is the plan. The Strepsiades has to go himself in favor of, in place of his son, because his son is a sportsman. He doesn't want to spend his time slaving away indoors and lose his tan and get out of shape. And so he has to go in his son's stead. And Strepsiades piously prays to the gods before he goes off to the thinkery. And this is so common. There are many people who will pray to God before they stake up a bank or something like that. You know, they see no contradiction or cognitive dissonance between praying to the gods and then doing something wrong, praying for success and being a scoundrel. Strepsiades knows himself to the extent that he knows that he's old and slow. He doesn't think that he's going to be able to handle the subtleties here. As it turns out, Strepsiades has a far more accurate assessment of his own character than the people he meets. So he goes to the thinker and he bangs on the door, and the student inside treats him as a buffoon and crude, and says that he caused the thought to miscarry. And of course, Socrates always claimed that he was followed his mother's profession as a midwife, sort of an allusion to Socrates and his career as a midwife of ideas, helping them to come to birth. And the student says, "I can't tell you what's going on in here because these things are mysteries. You're not initiated." And what Strepsiades says, "Well, okay, I've come here to be a student." And so the student says, "Well, I'll tell you then, but you must believe that these things are mysteries." And then he goes on and he explains what had just happened and what he had just interrupted. Apparently, a flea had jumped from Chaerephon's head to Socrates' head after biting Chaerephon on the eyebrow. And they immediately began to speculate how many feet a flea can leap. But they decide not to measure it in terms of human measurements, right? Our notion of feet. Because that's our convention that we're imposing upon nature, right? They want to know how many feet a flea can leap in flea feet, okay? Because that's nature's own measure, right? So there's a notion of objectivity here, of peeling away human categories and human conventions and seeing nature as it is and getting nature to tell its story in its own language, right? And so this is how they do it. They take some wax and they melt it and they dip the flea's feet in the wax and then they remove the flea feet after the wax cools and they have little slippers. And then they measure with obviously very tiny instruments the size of the flea's foot, and then they calculate how many flea feet a flea can leap. Okay? Now, this is obviously absurd, but it's serious playfulness, which we'll get to. Then the next topic they talk about is how do gnats hum? Do they hum from their anuses or from their mouths? And there's a complex theory about how it's actually through their anus that the gnats hum. And again, Socrates, you know, is unkinking and plumbing the anuses of gnats to figure out how they work out. Again, a very tiny thing. And Strepsiades is terribly impressed, you know, on where it says 165 on page 122, he said, "Then the gnat's anus is a trumpet, O thrice blessed for intestinal insight. How easily would a defendant escape the penalty if he thoroughly knew the intestine of the gnat?" And then the student mentions how lately Socrates was robbed of a great notion about the courses of the moon by a lizard. Socrates was peering up at the moon, taking astronomical observations, when a lizard crapped on him from the roof. And then he talks about how he contrived to get their barley for their last meal, because not only is the place infested with bugs, they're also extremely, extremely poor and hungry, and they have to steal food to get by. So, on page 122, the student says, he, meaning Socrates, sprinkled fine ash on the table, bent a meat spit, apparently they didn't need it for meat, okay, and then taking it as a compass, he made away with the cloak from the wrestling school. Now this is very obscure, but apparently what he did is he spread ash on a tabletop to create a surface in which he could inscribe, and then using a compass, he did some kind of complex geometrical proof, And while the people were gawking at Socrates' geometrical acumen, he somehow, having distracted the crowd, stole a cloak from the wrestling school and pawned it to buy food. I guess this is what's going on. Now, this is very interesting because suddenly you see that there's a connection that Aristophanes is hinting at between the activities of natural philosophers who are concerned about things like geometry and astronomy and the dishonest activities of sophists. He's pointing to some connection. It's a goofy connection, but he wants us to ponder what the underlying connection might be. Then the student admits Strepsiades into the thinkery, and he's aghast at how skinny and undernourished and pale they all are. And he notices that there are some students who are looking down at the earth. This is at top of 123. But why ever are these over there, or over here looking down at the earth? They're investigating the things beneath the earth. Then it's vegetable bulbs, he says. This is the first thing that comes to mind, right? Investigating things under the earth? Aha! Must be potatoes or turnips. These are practical things under the earth, and that's all that Strepsiades thinks in terms of. And then he tries to give them advice about where to find good vegetables. And, of course, they're not interested in that. They're delving into Erebus and Tartarus. They're delving into the secrets of the underworld. And apparently they're sort of bent over, so their heads are to the ground, but their rear ends are pointed to the sky. And Strepsiades says, then why is the anus looking at the heavens? And the student says, it itself by itself is being taught astronomy. Now this phrase, the itself by itself, is something you'll find in the Phaedo when we look at it. And it's a term that's used to refer to the forms. Plato's the idea of forms. Now there are people who argue, on the basis of ambiguous testimony from Aristotle, that Socrates didn't have a theory of forms, that he didn't talk about these eternal exemplars of the things that we see around us, the form of cup or animal or chair or whatever. But this is very good evidence that he did talk about this, because this text was written long before Plato's dialogues were written, even before Plato was born. So the theory of forms or ideas that you find in Plato is not Plato's creation that he foists on Socrates. There's good reason to think that it was something that Socrates himself thought up. And then the student says, we'll go inside so he won't happen upon us. Not yet, not yet. Let them stay so I can share a little matter of mine with them. I think this is a very maybe subtle allusion to a prominent theme later in the play, which is thuggery. We'll see that later. But the student says, no, they have to go inside. They can't take the air for very long. They're very delicate. Their health is very delicate. And then they look around, and they see instruments for observing the heavens, astronomical instruments, and then instruments of geometry. Now, the Greek word geometry literally means earth measurement. And so Strepsiades immediately thinks, oh, for land allotments, for dividing up the earth amongst people, as in surveying. Right, which is the origin of geometry, surveying. The student says, no, we're not measuring the earth around here. We're measuring the whole earth. We're measuring all of it. And Anaximander, who was the second Greek philosopher, the first student of Thales, was renowned to be the first man who created a map of the whole earth. And so this is very consistent with the early Greek thinkers. And Strepsiades thinks, well, this is very useful, you know, measuring out the whole earth. They show Socrates the map, and they point to Athens. Strepsiades points to Athens, and Strepsiades says, I don't believe that's Athens. Where are the law courts? Where are the judges? These are the things that are foremost on his mind, because he's got a lawsuit pending. And again, he wants to see the world drawn to the scale of his concerns. They're drawn to an objective geometric scale, the law courts don't show up. But drawn to the scale of his concerns, they would. And then he says, well, where are the Spartans, our enemies? And the student points to another dot, and he says, so close? Can't you move them a little further away? By the scale of human possibilities, you draw Sparta far away, but by the objective scale of geometry, you just have to put it where it is. And so there's a conflict here between two basic ways of looking at the world. Strepsiades looks at the world through the lens of human concerns, practical concerns, whereas the pre-Socratic thinkers in the thinkery have stepped outside the human condition. They've stepped outside the human perspective on things. They've put aside all their human concerns, and they're trying to see the world as it is in itself and measure it according to its own language and own scale, in a sense. And those are two very different perspectives on how to see the world. If you step outside the human condition and take up an objective scientific perspective on things, you tend to find that the human condition is the last thing you worry about. There is a tendency that Robert Almeter brought up in his talk, for the last talk for the Philosophical Society, for naturalists, scientific naturalists, to think that the language of science is the only objective language, and what about everything else? Well, it's poetry, it's politics, but it's not objective. It's all rhetoric, which is exactly the position of the ancient sophists, that it's all rhetoric, that it's history, that it's convention, all the way down. We've made up our nature, and we can remake it at will. There's no human nature. The only nature is non-human nature.
I think he's really being literal there.
I think he is. It's like, well, I don't see where the judges are. I mean, he could be being sarcastic, but I think that you have to read Strepsiades as a very literal-minded guy, because a lot of the jokes are actually based on very literal sort of misunderstandings of language. And then Socrates finally appears, and Socrates first appears in this play floating aloft in a basket. And this is a wonderful device for indicating how he's divorced himself from the human condition and the human point of view. He's floating above the earth. Strepsiades coaxes him down out of his basket. Socrates doesn't want to come down, first of all, though, and he refers to poor Strepsiades as a mere ephemeral one. Socrates is interested in the things that are, and the things that always will be. He's interested in the laws of nature. Strepsiades is just a human being. He's going to be dead pretty soon. He's ephemeral. Nature isn't. And so Socrates has concern with nature. And this is the basis of the natural philosopher's contempt for convention. Conventions change all the time, whereas nature never changes. Conventions change again from time to time and from place to place, but nature doesn't change at all, as the ancient Greeks understood it. And Socrates says he treads on air, he contemplates the sun, and Strepsiades says, so you're looking down on the gods from a perch. And the looking down on here has a dual meaning. It can mean literally looking down from above, but it can also mean condescending or being snooty about the gods. And both of those meanings are there, because it's very clear for that Socrates is an atheist as things go on. So anyway, and then we get a passage that sounds like these pre-Socratic fragments. This is at the bottom of page 124, the top of 125. Socrates says, I would never discover the matters aloft correctly, except by suspending mind and subtle thought and mixing them with their like, the air. If I consider the things above them from below in the ground, I would never discover them. For the earth forcefully pulls to itself the moisture from the thought. The same thing happens also to watercress. Mm. Now, this has quality of a lot of these fragments, because you say, what? You know, it does sound sort of demented and weird, but, you know, this is the kind of stuff that was early science. They had all these wild analogies and very mechanistic understandings of how things work. You know, thought is moist. You know, you have, if it dries out, then you can't think. Or Heraclitus thought that dry souls were the best and wet souls were the worst. So there was a debate. Is the dry or the wet soul the better soul? You know, the categories just don't seem to apply. It sounds like people tripping on acid, you know. Strepsiades says, well, look, tell me, I'm here to learn the unjust speech, the speech that doesn't pay anything back. And let's look in the center of page 125. He says, teach me the one of the two speeches, the one that pays nothing back. Whatever fee you set, I swear by the gods to pay you. I don't know about you, but if somebody said that to me, the first thing that would come to mind is what? What's peculiar about that declaration? Teach me the speech that pays nothing back, and I swear that I'll give you whatever fee you demand. Put it this way, if you go to a credit agency because your bills are in a shambles, I don't think any of these agencies will take you without first securing payment in advance. But if you go and you say, I'm sorry, I'm $100,000 in debt, I have all these credit cards that I haven't paid, help me out, and then bill me. It's not going to happen. The first thing a practical person would think of is, this is contradictory. If he wants to learn how to cheat, I'm not going to trust him to pay the bill later. I want the payment up front. But what's the first thing that Socrates fastens on? It's the fact that he swears an oath by the gods. Socrates he's just a deaf ear for those kinds of practical considerations, and he immediately focuses in on the fact that he swears by the gods, and he says, what gods indeed will you swear by? For first of all, we don't credit gods. And he says, well, what do you credit here? Iron coins? The very idea of disbelief in gods doesn't occur to him. So this idea of not giving the gods any credit, he thinks in terms of money. And this is the thing that's very comical about Strepsiades. He literally doesn't know what it means to be an atheist. Later on, when he promises not to recognize the other gods, he says, I promise, and if they should come up to me, I'll just ignore them. I'll snub them if they show up. Socrates says, well, I'll teach you divine matters plainly. And he also asks, will you associate in speech with the clouds, our daimons? Now that's very interesting. The very last line of 125, do you promise to associate in speech with the clouds, our daimons? Now, he just says that we don't credit any gods here, but you have to promise to associate in speech with them. Now, there's some reason to think that that's all Socrates' religiosity amounts to, is associating with them in speech. The Strepsiades goes into the thinkery for his instruction. Socrates refers to the clouds as the queen of all, the rulers of all. After Strepsiades comes out of the thinkery, Socrates does not ever mention the clouds. He doesn't ever recognize them. And instead he swears an oath to fraud, queen of all. If the clouds and fraud are queen of all, and there's only one queen, then we have to conclude that the clouds are fraud in the eyes of Socrates. And this would make sense of this locution, to associate with them in speech. The clouds are a kind of fiction for Socrates. And this is the sense that many of the Greeks had about these natural philosophers when they would appeal to a certain kind of god that was not the gods of the city. Yes, we don't believe in the gods of the city, but we believe that water is divine. People would think, are these people just condescending to us? Are they just tweaking us? Are they divinizing something that they don't think is divine for public consumption? There was a sense that the early Greek philosophers were entirely disingenuous about their professions of religiosity, and Socrates is in a very subtle way being shown to be that disingenuous here. But it's very interesting because the clouds actually play a role in the play. Socrates associates with them in speech, but he ignores, after he stops ignoring or starts ignoring them, they still function in the play. The clouds are real, even though Socrates recognizes them only as a fiction. And the question is, what then are the clouds? What do they represent? And what I want to say is that, at least as a preliminary notion, the clouds represent what you can call wisdom from nature, or wisdom according to nature, a wisdom that derives from following nature. Now, for Socrates, that's going to mean the kind of wisdom that you have with natural philosophy. But it's very interesting to note that Aristophanes himself also indicates that he's a follower of the clouds. In fact, he's one of them. Because there's a point in the play when Socrates and Strepsiades retire into the thinkery, and there's this little choral interlude where the chorus steps forward and sings this ode, that the lead cloud in the chorus steps forward. It's called the parabasis, which literally means stepping forward, and gives a speech to the audience. And it's very clear that the lead cloud is speaking on behalf of Aristophanes, which is very peculiar. So let's look a little forward, and we'll see how this works. Now, the first thing on top of 126 is that that Socrates goes through a little initiation ceremony to make Strepsiades part of the thinkery. Okay, and he sits him down on a couch and puts a wreath on his head and sprinkles him with flour from a can, And it's a kind of parody of the mystery initiations, or the initiations of the mystery religions. And these sorts of initiation rites were, of course, taken up by certain schools of philosophy like the Pythagoreans. And for Socrates, it's done in a kind of sloppy way. But at least there's some nod in the direction of treating the thinkery as a kind of religious organization, at least on the surface. And so they at least go through the forms of some kind of religious initiation, as well as pay lip service to the clouds. To associate in speech, you could translate more idiomatically as pay lip service to our daimons, the clouds. And then Socrates begins at the center of 126 he gives a speech or an invocation, I suppose, to the clouds. And the center, he says, O Master and Lord, measureless air, who holds the earth aloft, and bright ether, the august god, and august goddesses, clouds, sending thunder and lightning, arise, appear, O ladies, aloft for the thinker. And then Strepsiades, of course, acts silly throughout this. And finally, the chorus off stage at first begins to chant, and the chorus then slowly files in dressed as clouds. And all the actors in Greek plays were men, even the ones playing women's roles. So there was a group of men who would come in dressed as women who were clouds. So they would probably come in wearing white flowing robes, things like that, and masks or things to cover the fact that they had beards. And they filed in slowly, chanting. And if anyone's ever seen Japanese no theater, this is probably what the Greek plays were like. Extremely static, hieratic, very slow-moving, very ritualized kind of chanting. You have to be a real connoisseur or you'll just go crazy watching this stuff because nothing ever seems to happen. For me, it's like watching baseball. Okay? Tearing my hair out. Well, something please happen here, you know. But that's the way no theater is, too. It's like 2 minutes of action crammed into 3 hours. Okay. But anyway, imagine them slowly coming in their very, very formalized poses, tiptoeing in. Center of 128. Socrates begins to characterize the clouds, and he does so very interestingly at the center of 128. He says, "They're heavenly clouds, great goddesses for idle men, who provide us with notions and dialectic and mind, and marvel-telling and circumlocution and striking and seizing." And here we have two lists, basically. First of all, idle men refers to, the word for that, the Greek word is the root of the word scholar, which just means idle layabouts, good for nothing. These idle men include, first of all, those who talk about notions and dialectic and mind, and those would be the natural philosophers, but also the marvel tellers, the fish tale tellers, the dog story tellers, the circumlocutors, the people who talk around topics, and the strikers and seizers and smash-and-grab artists, these are the sophists. So the sophists and the natural philosophers are nourished by the clouds. So these people are nourished because they have a notion of what's wise according to nature. And it's essentially the same conception of nature that they have, both the sophists and the natural philosophers. And that's really the underlying identity that Aristophanes is trying to make us see in this play. Between two groups look very, very different on the surface, but underlying them is the same view of the nature of the relationship of nature to convention and the relative worth of the two. And then at the center of 129, or a little above the center, Socrates says, where it says 330 in the margin, he says, "Then don't you know by Zeus," Socrates says, "that they nourish, the clouds nourish, most of the sophists, Thurian diviners, practicers of the art of medicine." And in this context, that just means quacks, okay? Thurian diviners, astrologers, medical quacks, idle long-haired onyx ring wearers, good-for-nothing sorts, song modulators of circling choruses, men who are imposters about the things aloft, rampa, equivalent today. Idle do-nothings they nourish too because they make poetry and music about these clouds. So this is interesting. The whole sort of counterculture set, what we call the New Age crowd today, astrologers, spiritual healers, channelers, these types are being included here. I think this is what he means by Thurian diviners, right? They're figuring out the future. practitioners of the art of medicine. Medicine wasn't considered much of a science at the time. Idle, long-haired onyx ring wearers. The whole little five-point community encapsulated in this passage.
It's a thing of Monty Python.